Hello and welcome to Assumptions, a series that investigates the bias in us all. To assume, as the saying goes, is to make an ass out of you and me. Well, mostly you. It's about how you can be as stubborn as a donkey when you just know you're right, only to find out that perhaps you're wrong. That's okay, you're only human, but I'm not. I'm Susan Carlin, and I promise to be gentle as I take you on a fact-checking journey into the assumptions you may never have even thought to question. Like helmets, keeping bike riders safe.
If you're out on your bicycle and you're unfortunate enough to have an accident, it's not particularly effective against serious irreversible brain damage.
And the assumptions that can make and break a relationship.
I assume that he will talk to me on the phone when I'm out of town.
Yeah.
And he won't.
But first, if there's one thing we learnt from kids' cartoons, it's that people who live alone are grumpy, scowling outcasts who never throw our ball back over the fence. And we might have stuck with that stereotype if it wasn't for those meddling researchers. They've found that a quarter of all Australian homes are single-person households, and that those single persons aren't the miserable recluses Scooby-Doo and co. would have us believe. Here to discuss how that is even possible is Professor David DeVoe from the Australian Institute of Family Studies. David, welcome.
Hi, Susan.
How many Australians live alone and who are they in the main?
About 2 million adults live alone in Australia. You can put them in three different groups, actually. You've got the younger group, those in their sort of 20s and 30s. Often they're pre-partnering. So it's in that stage before they've had families. There's more men than women in that group, but the women in that group are a particularly interesting group. They're pretty well off, pretty educated, professional jobs, good income. Then there's the middle age group in their 40s and their 50s. Predominantly, they're people who have partnered and are then separated. Then there's the older group, and these are predominantly women in their 60s, 70s and 80s, and they're predominantly widows.
Right.
And they're three very different groups, and they have very different experiences. And so living alone in part really depends on whose shoes you're standing in, really.
Your research has shown that a number of people living alone in Australia, the number increased steadily since the Second World War, and they peaked at about our current level about 10 years ago. What's the dominant social attitude towards this? How do we as a society perceive this trend?
If you look in lots of media reports and other reports and simply talk to people, I think they get a bad press overall. There's a bit of a stereotype of them, some people who live alone, as being losers, those who can't make a go of it. They can't get a relationship or can't keep a relationship, or no one wants to live with them anyway, who would, type thing. That's one part of the stereotype. The other part of the stereotype, I think, is they're isolated, that they don't have friends, that they're cut off, a bit selfish, don't really honour their obligations to family and so forth. So, you know, if they're not sad and depressed, then they're selfish. Now, I think some of that's breaking down a little bit, but it's still a pretty dominant discourse in many quarters. Some people paint the picture of a society sort of fragmenting and breaking down where people can't relate. So there has been, in some quarters, sort of a moral panic as to what does this signify.
So there does seem to be this perception that the person living alone is sitting angrily on their couch, scowling at the world, not engaging. How true is that stereotype?
Not very. You can pick up some things that of people who live alone, there is a greater level of loneliness, and they'll say that. But it's not the majority. It's still a minority, and it's not all that many more than people who live with others. Lots of people who live with others say, I'm lonely too.
Right. Your research has found in Australia that there are plenty of people who choose to live alone. Are they happy to live alone? Can it be tied to social advantage in any way?
In terms of happy to live alone, if you ask people who are living alone, do they prefer to live alone, then the majority, round about two-thirds, say, yeah, I prefer to live alone. Now, they're not all itching to get out of that arrangement. What are they saying when I say I prefer to live alone? It's in fact your oldest people who live alone are most likely to say I prefer to live alone. But I think they're probably saying in that context, I'd rather live alone than in an institution, or I'd rather live alone than have to move in with my kids. And I think that's true for many of the younger people, especially those who do have choices. They're saying, I'd prefer to live alone than get into an unsatisfactory relationship or to persist with an unsatisfactory relationship. So the preference is there. There is a lot of active choice involved. And that's truer, I think, amongst some of your younger folk. The group who don't like living alone as much are sort of more your middle-aged men, actually,
who
are living alone more often than not because they've separated and divorced. So there's a lot of loss and other things associated with that.
Mm.
So living alone for them is part of a wider experience of things aren't going so well.
And is their level of dissatisfaction similar to women of the same age group in the same circumstance?
No, it's higher. The group that like living alone the most are your younger women in their 20s and 30s, professional, well-educated, good income.
What does your research say about the assumption that living alone is lonely or miserable or a potential breakdown in the fabric of society?
The general picture is it's none of those. The general picture is that people who live alone continue to engage with their friends, mix with them, continue to mix and engage with their family. It's not as though they give up on those things.
That said, as you mentioned, it's obviously not true for everyone. There are exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the exceptions and why are they unhappy?
The group that sort of stands out to me most is the middle-aged men in their 40s and 50s where they're living alone less by choice and more from circumstance, where their relationship is broken down. They don't end up with the children, so they're living alone. Their former partner more often than not will have the children, so she's not alone. But he is alone and doesn't necessarily have access to his family. The other thing is that men in that middle-aged group who do live alone, they're less educated. They have poorer jobs, or quite often don't have jobs, and their incomes are lower. So they're not doing as well on a number of dimensions. And that's the group, I think, where there's some cause for a little bit of concern. The other group is probably some of the older folk who live alone, where there are health issues and perhaps some isolation issues. But in general, that's not a strong message that we get with the older folk, because there are often more community supports and ageing in place supports for older folk than there are for the group of middle-aged men.
But overall, it sounds like what you're saying is it's not as big a worry as some social researchers or the average person on the streets lead us to believe.
No, I mean, if there's one message that I think comes out of the research, it is that there isn't a cause for some moral panic, if you like, about this changing form of living arrangement. I mean, living arrangements have always changed. Household forms have always changed. They're continuing to do so. And to paint the picture that's always from some golden age where everyone lived in happy families to now where you've got, you know, all these people living on their own isolated, is simply not an accurate picture.
Research Fellow at the Australian Institute of Family Studies, Professor David DeVoe, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And you are listening to Susan Carland on Assumptions on RN. From the upside of single to the downside of double, if there is one place where assumptions can accumulate, it's in a relationship. Everything from who is the romantic one to who reunites the family's lost socks, and why is it always up to me to get the damn milk? Tell Us What You Really Think is a segment where we invite a brave soul to tell the world about the assumptions they love and hate. I took comedian Michelle Laurie out for a coffee to have a good whinge about our husbands. I mean, to talk about the assumptions that affect our relationships.
Would anyone like a coffee or anything?
Yes, can I have a flat white, please? With two artificial sweeteners. I know it's gross, but that's where I'm at now.
Everyone's
in my life.
Everybody, yeah. Can I get tea? Please, English breakfast with lots of milk, please.
Michelle, tell us about a time that you have made some pretty catastrophic assumptions in a relationship.
Well, I've only ever really had one serious relationship.
Me too.
Right.
Aren't we
so,
women in the world?
Yeah, right. So all the catastrophic assumptions I've made have been about the one relationship. Probably the worst one was assuming that whatever I did, my husband Adrian would go along with eventually. And he
what
did.
Could go wrong?
He did for ages. He went along with all the rescue dogs, all the house moves, all that stuff.
Yes.
Until I said, let's have a baby right now. We need IVF. And by the way, I told them to put two in. And that's...
And that was the tipping point.
That was the tipping point, yeah. And then I'm going straight back to work and you have to do most of the caring.
Right. So there was quite a bit in there.
Yeah.
Strangely.
And I assumed... He didn't. And I assumed, like, with the rescue dogs, he would eventually... just, you know, not really even notice they were around and just incorporate them into his life. And he, you know, he didn't. He found them very stressful and he was very resentful.
Really?
Yeah.
So it caused a lot of problems.
Yeah, well, yeah, we separated for a year. Yep.
Right, and then you got back together.
We did, yeah. We had a lot of counselling and a key part of that counselling for me was not assuming so much and not just taking for granted that he will be there to clean up after me.
So have there been any times where you've made assumptions and that's actually worked really well?
Yeah, I mean, I assumed we'd stay together.
Yeah.
I assumed we'd get back together. I mean, I must admit, I assumed that our counsellor would say that it was all Adrian's fault and would help him to overcome... But help him to understand.
Should be pretty quick counselling session, one needed for that.
But, you know, in the end, it was a little bit more complicated than that.
I know when I was thinking about this segment, it's hard sometimes to be aware of the assumptions, especially when you've been with someone for a long time, because they just become either given or you thought about them ages ago and forgotten them.
Yep.
Do you have anything like that in your relationship where it's not a game changer?
Yeah.
But neither side can let go of the way things are supposed to be.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I assume that he will talk to me on the phone when I'm out of town.
Yeah.
And he won't. And I will phone and I'll be like, hey, like we haven't seen each other in 24 hours. And he's like, yep.
Like screening your calls.
Yeah, he's just like, yep. I assume he'll bath the kids when I'm out of town. Never happens. He assumes that when he's had too much to drink and starts sending me weird text messages, that I'll be okay with that. And I'm not. I'm really not.
One of the biggest assumptions that seems to come up again and again is the domestic labour divide.
Absolutely.
Who does what?
Yeah.
Who's just expected to do what?
Yeah.
How have you negotiated that?
He's pretty good, but I mean, still there's an assumption in the outside world that I'm the mum, so there are certain things that are my responsibility and that you talk to me about.
Yeah.
No matter how many times I say you have to call Adrian because he's home with the kids in the morning and I'm not. But then at the same time, tradies come to the house and will only speak to him. And he doesn't care. He doesn't care where the tiles are going in the kitchen. That's all me. And I'm paying for it. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm asking you a question. Answer me.
Yes.
But they don't. But the same with people with the kids. He will ask a question of a mum or a teacher or whoever, and they will turn and deliver the answer to me.
That's our assumptions outside about the relationship.
Yeah, for sure. The ladies at kinder and now at school are so forgiving of him.
Yes.
They just assume he's a miracle worker because he's at home alone with the
kids. Oh my God, father of the year.
Oh, and yeah, they were an hour late, but you know.
He tries.
Good on him. You know, good on him.
He knows the kids' name.
Right? And good on him for getting them here in shoes. What a clever sausage he is. You know, meanwhile, where were their readers?
I know, while you're neglecting them.
Yeah, right. I don't know where their readers are. Yeah, a lot of assumptions still.
Yeah,
I know. And from women, which is like, God, come on, you get it. Surely you get it. You know that I'm not the only person responsible for these humans.
Yes.
And yet everyone kind of holds me responsible for those humans.
It's hard enough when it's inside the relationship, yet when it's coming from outside to try to force you back into a certain way.
But then I assume that he will do manly stuff and he won't. Like he doesn't, you know, I go, there's a light out or the paving has buckled and the door won't shut anymore or whatever. And he kind of looks at me like...
Why are you telling me?
Yeah, good chat. And I think, I am assuming that you will do butch things.
And it's funny, it's the same in our house. And so it got to the stage where Waleed will never do anything handy. And so we needed to have our dryer installed on the wall. So I rang Hire a Hubby. And before I rang them, I actually said to Waleed, is it emasculating for you that I'm calling a company called hire a hubby.
I know.
And he's like, nah, don't care.
No, my husband called them. He got his own hire a hubby.
In the end, from what you've said, at least in your experience, assumptions can either make a relationship or break a relationship.
Or make and break it.
Yes. And I think it's impossible probably to have relationships without assumptions.
Oh, I think you've got to have the assumption that you're staying together, haven't you?
I'm Susan Cullen. We've been here at a delightful cafe in Richmond with the amazingly, hilariously successful and well-balanced Michelle Laurie. Thank you so much.
Thank you. What a great outro.
And if that rang a bell for you, how about this? Whether you like it or not, these days in Australia, riding a bike is not so much an activity as a cultural statement. It's become a sport in itself, loving to hate cyclists, those pesky riders whizzing through red lights in peak hour, but it's a two-way street with cyclists and their one less car stickers pointedly aimed at stinky car drivers. It has a deadly serious side though, and it's writ large on our road fatality statistics. Australia is one of the few countries in the world where wearing helmets is mandatory. But are those laws wrong-headed? Here to discuss this is Alan Todd, National President of Freestyle Cyclists. Alan, does wearing a bike helmet make riding a bike safer?
A simple question, and like all simple questions, it really needs a slightly complex answer. But basically, does wearing a helmet on a bike make us safer? The answer is yes and no.
Oh.
If you're out on your bicycle and you're unfortunate enough to have an accident and you are wearing a helmet, it may offer you some limited protection against some level of injury to your head. It'll probably be not nearly as much as you think it would. It'll be no use whatsoever against serious impacts from fast-moving heavy vehicles. And it's not particularly effective against the kinds of injuries that really worry us most. And I said there was a second part to that question, and that is, if I decide every time I get in a bicycle for the rest of my life, I'll put a helmet on, it actually won't make me any safer. It may actually make me slightly less safe. The reason being that when you wear a supposed protective device, things change. You don't just carry on as you were before, things change. And it's been well established that risk compensation enters into the picture. People tend to ride a bit more recklessly, ride faster. Motorists give less clearance to cyclists who are wearing helmets than ones who aren't. That has been measured.
What's so bad about wearing a helmet?
I'm not really interested in the reasons why people don't want to wear helmets. The fact is they don't. One in five Australians say that they would ride a bike or ride a bike more often if they didn't have to wear a helmet. It's been estimated by the European Cycling Federation that if Australia were to repeal its mandatory helmet law, you'd get a doubling in participation in cycling overnight. So let's not get too hung up on why don't people want to wear a helmet. Let's accept, like in all good health and safety planning, you deal with people like they are, not like you'd like them to be. When bike helmets became mandatory, cycling levels dropped between 22 and 50%, depending on the demographic. Head injuries dropped about the same.
Maybe wearing a helmet doesn't make as much of a difference as we may assume, but surely it's better than not wearing one at all.
Cycling is often called dangerous. Riding a bike is not dangerous. Driving a car is dangerous. Riding a bike, you're vulnerable. Now, the vulnerable have to be treated differently from people who are actively dangerous. And in saying you're vulnerable, it doesn't say you're unsafe. It says you can be unsafe. So the vulnerable in an unsafe situation, such as a cyclist on arterial roads where there's a lot of traffic conflict, they may be unsafe. But to make them safe, you don't say, okay, we're going to put you in an unsafe situation. We're going to put a little polystyrene helmet on the top of your head. It won't protect your face, your neck, your liver, your spleen, your legs, whatever. It might protect the top of your head with an effectiveness of about 15%. Carry on business as usual. It's an appalling way to do safety. Cyclists have been really, really shortchanged on this. The helmet becomes this sort of stand-in for all safety for cyclists. We focus on it an incredible amount. It's compulsory. It's very easy for the police to spot you if you're not wearing one. It's become entrenched as this thing cyclists have to do to be safe. And it's distracted from the things that really make cycling safe.
It sounds like what you're saying is that it's not that helmets are entirely negative and we should have a massive global bonfire with helmets. It's that helmet wearing, and especially compulsory helmet wearing, has become something of a proxy argument where we focus all about cyclists wearing helmets and then take no
sense of responsibility or awareness for other areas that might actually do more to create cyclist safety.
You've hit it in one. That's very much on the money. When the legislation was first foisted on us in Victoria, it was part of a 3-point safety initiative. And the other 2 points were going to be public awareness around cycling safety. That's the second least effective way of making people safe. And the third was going to be dedicated infrastructure. The two other initiatives, of course, never happened.
What do you think are the more meaningful things that can be done to protect bicycle riding safety?
Properly designed road systems with busy roads, if there is a need to use these busy roads with bicycles, physically separated lanes. On smaller roads where it's impractical to have a physically separated lane, you need slower speed limits. You always need measures to make it more inconvenient to drive than to cycle. No city in the world has been successful in getting their people on bikes if they haven't concurrently made it a bit harder to use cars. Intersection treatments. A lot of accidents happen at intersections. Possibly the least important is awareness campaigns. I mean, they're the cheapest thing to do, and that's why governments like them. I can understand that. Nobody likes to spend public money. But awareness campaigns are probably the least effective. In the Netherlands, when somebody has a fatal accident on a bicycle, they don't go around preaching to people about how they should drive or ride. They actually fix the place where it happened.
Right.
And that's what we're really lacking here.
But on the issue of infrastructure, developing infrastructure systems takes an incredibly long time.
That's an excuse.
But do you think at least in the interim, while in, you know, really congested cities already like Sydney or Melbourne, while proper bike lanes are being implemented, things like compulsory bicycle helmets are a good interim measure?
No. The use of personal protective equipment in any system is there for when the system fails. It's an acceptance that you failed to say, we can't make you safe, but if you get knocked in the head, well, we'll make it slightly safer. For transport cyclists, or what I call utility cyclists, people who just use a bike to get around, the helmet is not a particularly useful thing. To say in the interim is just, frankly, excusism. I've been hearing that argument for over 20 years. To my mind, it beggars belief that in one of the fattest nations on earth, we should actually put barriers in the way of people getting out of their cars and getting onto bicycles. To say that someone should be denied the benefit of bicycle riding because they don't wish to wear a helmet for whatever reason, why should you be denied the benefits of bicycle riding? There goes half the women in the world. They don't want to muck their hair up. That's often treated as trivial, but it's not trivial. How you present in public is incredibly important. And societies through the ages have set a lot of store on how our head is adorned. It's a major feature of how we identify ourselves. So this was a clumsy...
You're speaking to the converted with that.
Yeah. This was a clumsy law, well-intentioned but ill thought out. And after 25 years, no one else in the world wants to do it. Waiting for infrastructure, they didn't wait in London, they didn't wait in Paris, they didn't wait in New York. We often get hung up on the Netherlands because they are the poster child of developed cycling. They are the best. But London, New York and Paris are places that Australians can relate to. They don't generally think that they're places with calm traffic and, you know, nice people walking around slowly and using bicycles. But bicycle use in these cities has really grown.
What does their experience tell us about how cyclists can be safe without helmets? What can we learn from that situation?
You want to get more cyclists on the road. That's the main thing. There's a really strong correlation between numbers of cyclists and how safe the individual cyclists are. If you double the number of people riding a bike, you won't double the number of accidents. You'll increase the number a little bit because more people, more accidents. But there's an increasing safety return the more people you get out on bicycles. At the moment, cyclists are sort of set off as a separate species, and you hear people talking about doing things for cyclists. If you go to Copenhagen, they don't know what you're talking about. What's a cyclist? You're not a cyclist, I'm not a cyclist, but we use bikes to get around. In Australia, we don't identify ourselves as drivers, but most people drive.
If the evidence that helmets are so useful isn't as watertight as we're led to believe,
Why are we so hung up on having compulsory helmets in Australia?
I wish I could give you a simple answer to that. I really don't know. The helmets, they've really been fetishised beyond all usefulness in Australia. You know, people scream at you on the street, "Where's your helmet?" You can walk down the street with a tin of beer in your hand, smoking a cigarette, and nobody will say, "Stop smoking!" But, you know, smoking and drinking will kill you way, way, way before riding a bicycle will.
Well, sadly, it's time for me to jump on my bike, take my life into my hands, and get out of here with my helmet on. In fact, I'm so law-abiding, I wear two helmets. The bike helmet legislation in Australia is the subject of very heated research wars. If you'd like to know more about them, we've put a few articles on our website to get you started. And tell us your thoughts about bike helmets or who should buy the milk in your house just once as a nice surprise, for God's sake, or another assumption altogether that drives you up the wall. You can download our podcast from the RN website, which is what all the fashionable people are doing. Try to keep up. But until next time, I'm Susan Carland, and keep pondering those assumptions.